Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 318, being recorded on the 4th of March, 2020. Today, it's going to be just Cynthia Crane and myself, Sujit DeMello. We're going to talk about a couple of things that we've been working on in the past few weeks in our respective roles. Some things that I think may be of interest to our listeners in the Azure space. But before that, as usual, let's get on with the news in the Azure space this past week. So there's a few links that Evan and Kale have dropped into our show notes. I'll get started, Cynthia. One of them that I thought was interesting was the fact that the classic ASM-based VMs are finally going away. This is, you know, back in the day when Azure first started, you could use ASM, the Azure Service Model, I want to say is what it stands for. But using that old model, which was not based on a template, everything was based on, these weird command lines. That starting from today, actually, you won't be able to create new VMs using the ASM model. And then I think in 2 years from now, you even the ones that are running will not be able to start. So what this means is that anyone who's still using ASM-based VMs has to start thinking about migrating it over. You know, there's all these great functionality that's available in the ARM model. Obviously, you could use templates. You can have the scaling, the parallel deployment of all your VMs, all the new, fancy VM scale sets, all the additional facilities available for you in the VM world are all available in the ARM world. So definitely want to take advantage of that and move over.
What else?
Anything you want to discuss, Ken, Cynthia?
The one that I thought was very interesting was the Express Route Global Reach.
Mm-hmm.
So in the past, what most customers have been using Express Route is to connect securely from their on-prem data centers into Azure. But right now, what is available is that each Express Route needs to be associated with a specific region. And even if you do have multiple Express Route circuits, they don't actually have the ability to talk to each other. But with Express Route Global Reach, now you're actually able to take advantage of Azure's global network and be able to have your Express Routes in different regions communicate with each other still under this secure global network. So we're essentially extending our infrastructure to allow customers to build their own global network that connects to their on-prem data centers, as well as all the different Azure regions.
That's cool. So they're actually using Microsoft's backbone to extend their own global reach, the customer's global reach.
Correct.
That's awesome. Very nice. Well, one final bit of update that came on was with Azure Cost Management, always top of mind for our customers, how to keep on top of the Azure costs, which sometimes tend to be more than you expect. They've got these new Power BI reports now, which help you monitor some of the costs in Azure, and specifically if you're using Azure Reserved Instances or if you have a hybrid benefit, with the licensing of Windows, that you can surfaces all of those savings for you. And then there's a whole bunch of new updates that they've announced, which we'll put a link in the show notes. But these are mostly in terms of enhancements that are coming up in the billing tab in the Azure portal. So that's it for the news. So Cynthia, I believe this week we thought we'd take some time to share what we're working on, right? In relates to Azure. I know you are doing some pretty cool things with getting your colleagues upskilled in Azure, in the fundamentals of Azure. So let's start with that. What are you like? What is this new program that you're in?
Sure. So as probably a lot of our listeners know, there's a AZ-900 certification exam. And right now, that's actually one of the fundamental certifications that's required of all the technical account manager and probably a number of other roles as well. That from a Microsoft perspective, we're really hoping to scale everyone up in the technical acumen. Like, we don't necessarily want to just be able to talk to customers, but we want to be able to understand at least at a 100 level what we're talking about and how can we really go a little deeper than just say, oh, you want to know about Azure? Let me find you someone that can talk to you about that. So that's something that I've actually been doing for the past couple months.
So I want to understand something. The AZ-900, is that similar to the AWS practitioner's exam or practitioner certification?
I have no idea.
Okay, I know there's
what is
similar.
Covered in the practitioner exam.
It's it's basically the fundamentals of AWS, right? It's for somebody who, as you said, like who wants to work with the cloud, but not necessarily get too deep. Obviously you want to talk to customers intelligently, things like that.
So from what you're saying, it probably is very similar because right now fundamentals, it doesn't cover any implementation details, but it covers at a high level of each of the big buckets of like understanding what the cloud is, what are the core Azure services that you have available to, if you're looking at compute, networking, storage, each of these big groups, like what each of them do, and also on like a security and compliance side, what is available and what Azure can provide in terms of things like Azure Security Center or Key Vaults. And then the other interesting thing that I think is included in this whole module is also learning about how Azure gets priced and how it's supported. Because I think these are two aspects that are a lot of times overlooked when people first approach Azure, that they just want to hit the ground running, that they don't really consider like, oh, there's actually considerations I need to think about ingress and egress, depending on which region I choose to have it in, different tiers of support that you can get and how you want to manage your subscription. Like you were just talking about, like cost management becomes a ongoing topic that we have with all our customers, regardless of how long they've been in the cloud.
Yeah, I believe also things like SLAs and all are covered, right, in that exam?
Yep. How we calculate our SLAs. I also learned recently myself that the way we calculate SLAs for Azure services and the way we calculate SLAs for O365 is very different. And even within each service, sometimes there are ways that we calculate with downtime. There's others that we calculate with like user time affected across your entire tenant. So those are all things that are very important to consider because we want to make sure that our customers are fully supported. And when they do experience an outage, they are getting the credits that they deserve or that we tell our customers they will get.
Now, how deep does it go in terms of networking? Does it cover any networking topics in the Azure Fundamentals?
It does. But just to the extent of understanding like VNets, network security groups, firewall, what are DDoS protection and the corresponding security solutions. But you don't need to know how to carve out different subnets. Like that's not covered. You don't need to know how to actually create those things. You just need to be aware of those different concepts that are involved.
How about different like compute options? Are they covered, like web apps and whatever, IaaS and things like that. Is that something that's covered there?
Yes. So IaaS versus PaaS versus SaaS is one of the first thing we cover between the differences. And then in terms of compute options, there's what the VMs, the VM skill sets, the Azure functions, web apps. Again, these are all covered at like a what they are level and a little bit of how you should think about using them, but not, again, not into the implement details of how do we set up a pipeline to deploy to a web app and how does that differ to deploying to an Azure function. So we don't go that in depth, but
but speaking of pipelines, so is DevOps covered at all?
A little bit. Because right now I'm reading the, what is it called? The rubrics. It says one of the requirements is describe DevOps solutions available on Azure, such as Azure DevOps and Azure DevTest Labs.
Okay, so you definitely have to know the basics of DevOps at least. But you don't have to be a developer, obviously. I'm just not targeting developers. It's more like management staff kind of thing, technical managers, that kind of thing.
So it's actually intended for people with non-technical backgrounds.
Okay.
That's people that are really involved, everybody. But not in it.
Yep. That should be all our listeners at minimum, I would expect, if not more.
Yeah, and really there's a ton of great resources from, what is it called, MS Learning, Microsoft Learning, that there's actually a dedicated track for Azure Fundamentals. It's broken down in a very nice modular fashion, and it also is gamified, so you get points to go through the readings, to answer the questions, and if memory serves me right, there's also the option to spin up a small sandbox environment within the learning portal, and you can start interacting with Azure with Azure CLI, so you can create VMs there. And it's only good for what, 4 or 24 hours, and it gets deallocated. But it was really cool when I did it.
Nice.
Now, and I think it's also a lot less intimidating doing it in the environment in a guided fashion.
Yeah, that's good. What would you say is like the time commitment to go through all of that training, that material for the, you know, before you go for the actual exam, for example?
So for people that have, I believe like people that are our listeners have already some level of understanding for Azure, but for people that are starting at ground zero, I say about 8 to 10 hours should be enough for you to go through the materials and be comfortable with the certification exam.
Okay, nice. Yeah, I think I did that exam last year, the AZ-900. We also had to do it in our team. And it was not too difficult. I mean, you know, it's kind of funny. There's a lot of things you take for granted, right? I mean, you and I have been in the Azure space for a while. And so we forget all the little fundamental details that are covered in this. And so it requires a little bit of revision and refresh. It's good to have that either way. But I didn't think the exam was, it's not like a tricky exam as far as I recall. It's not, you know, they're not trying to trick you with tricky questions and all that. It's pretty straightforward, I believe.
And I think most of, if not all of them, are multiple choice.
I believe that's true, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, it's very different from all the later exams that you take on Azure where it actually requires you to implement something. I think it's a great place to enter into the Azure world and feel comfortable and more confident in how you talk with different people. But yeah, it's fun and it's interesting. Me right now approaching it from the perspective of a technical account manager, where when I talk to my peers, I approach it in the sense of these are the areas why it matters to us. Because I think a lot of people feel like this is more of a technical topic, that this is not necessarily something they're super interested in and want to invest time in. But there are also a lot of aspects that will affect really everyone else, but just at different extent.
Yeah.
But enough about Azure Fundamentals, Suji. What are you working on?
Yeah, so, you know, off late, I've been working with VMware. You know, they have they acquired Pivotal Software, which is, it makes the Pivotal Cloud Foundry, and so we're helping them integrate that better with some of the Azure services out there. So as part of that, I'm doing a I've kind of deployed their code, which is all written in Go on my laptop, and I'm trying to be able to run it. I'm running it inside Windows subsystem for Linux, which is great. On Windows, as you know, it works really nicely. You could also do it on a Mac or on a Linux box, but I was doing it on WSL. And, I can get the code running, and the code eventually goes and deploys some Azure resources, and then it tries to connect to those Azure resources, right? And the thing is that these Azure resources are actually deployed on a network, on a VNet. They're attached to a VNet. And as you know, if an Azure resource is attached to a VNet, you can't just connect to it from your laptop, right? It's basically blocked from the internet at that point. It's only available on that VNet. And so this kind of a conundrum is like, how do I test this now? It's deployed, but how do I access it? There's no way to test that service from my laptop. And so I said, okay, I'll do the next obvious thing, which is, I spun up a CentOS VM on that machine. On that VNet, right, which I was testing, and I've deployed all the software there, the Pivotal software there, and great. So that became my develop machine now, that CentOS box, where I could run all the code over there. And obviously that could access the resources because it's on the same VNet.
So it's like a jump box?
It's kind of like a jump box, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But now, have you ever tried doing development on a Linux box?
I have not.
Yeah, I mean, it's great for running stuff, but when it comes to editing stuff and making changes, VI only goes so far, right? That's the editor that comes with Linux.
Oh, actually, now that you've said it, I have. I've okay. only done it in college, but nothing after that. And it's always funny because I have to remember that we have to log into. So every time we go to the computer, we can decide if we want to log into a Linux machine or a Windows machine. And then once you're in Linux, you're like, oh, okay, I need to go to this ugly text editor because there's nothing else. And then you can run C++, and then everyone would tell us like, oh, it's better if you have a Mac because Unix is a lot easier. You can just run it on your computer. Xcode makes it so much prettier. So yes, I remember.
Yeah. So all of those things, right, from a developer perspective, like I had everything set up. I have on my development tool, my Visual Studio Code, whatever, everything else is on my laptop. So I really wanted to use my laptop for developing, but I can't run it, right? I have to run it in this Linux box. So this is a problem I was trying to solve, is how do I do the development on my laptop but run it on the Linux box, which is attached to the VNet in Azure? And so what I came up with a solution where I used Azure Files as a central binding mechanism. I went into Azure Files and I set up a file share, just pretty easy there. It sets up an SMB file share essentially. And then there's a set of steps that you have to do to mount that file share from the Linux box, the CentOS box, which is on the VNet. And those are clearly described on the website. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But once you go through those steps, which take about 5 or 10 minutes, then you have a mount. You can actually mount that Azure Files location from the CentOS box. Then what I did is I came to my laptop and I did the same thing from WSL. I went through similar steps on WSL to mount to that same file share. And so now I have both WSL mounted to the file share. I have the Linux box mounted to the same file share. And I copied all the the Git repo that I was working on. I put it on the file share. So now this way, both, we're accessing the same files from both locations. And then I used the Visual Studio Code integration with WSL feature, right? Where you can just say you're on WSL shell, in a bash shell, you can just say code and dot, right? Code space dot, and then it would launch code, and code will actually open up all your files in your WSL file system. In this case, it's the mounted file system. And so I was able to do all the development in Visual Studio Code on my laptop, all the IntelliSense, all the extensions, all that cool stuff. And then when I made changes, I saved them, and this way I just went over, I just SSH into my Linux box, and I ran the code, and it worked there. So this was a way where I could get the best of both worlds, where I was able to develop on my machine, on my laptop, but run it in Azure and have that very quick turnaround. You know, where you're not You don't have to like check it into some repository and then check it out there or clone the repo again and things like that. It was very quick turnaround for development. So I thought that, you know, that was a nice way of using Azure Files as a central mechanism to do that. And I was a little worried actually that the performance might suffer a little bit because it is Azure, you know, you're mounting a file and you're doing compilation and development on a shared file system. But I didn't notice any performance penalties.
When you mount it, does it become local or does it like ping the Azure servers every time you're trying to do something about it?
No, it just mounts as a file. So /mnt/whatever the name of the file mount file share is, you know, it just mounts it as if it's a local file share. But under the covers, that is connected to the Azure Files. It's basically just standard MNT, the SMB file share system that's built into Linux and most other operating systems. So it essentially just works on using the SMB file protocol.
So I'm thinking it in terms of like OneDrive terms. Mm-hmm. So in OneDrive, there's an option to like save it locally and then sync it to the cloud or just have a cloud copy. When you say you mount a file share, like which type will you be working with then?
It's not local. So you're actually working directly on the file share.
Gotcha.
There's nothing local at that point in time. It just appears local to you as if it's a local drive letter or a local file folder. But that folder is actually pointing directly to the file share, the Azure file share. And so this way, every time you make a change, you save it, it's actually saved on the file share instantly. And the other side, the Linux box is seeing that instantly because, you know, it's looking at the same file share. I make a change and I run the program on the other side and it's there right away. So that was a pretty cool way. And hopefully our listeners can leverage that feature.
Yeah, I now remember I've actually done a similar thing for one of my customers where there are repeating files across a number of their web servers. And instead of making multiple copies, they just all refer to a Azure Files location because then they now can just share one copy of the same thing.
You're right. And that is
maintaining changes is also a lot easier that way because now you maintain one change instead of like 10 or 20 changes.
This is the number one use case for Azure Files in my mind is when you have shared configuration. That's definitely the number one use case for using Azure Files, where you essentially are writing less often but reading more often, right? Because writing is still a performance impact. But so as long as you know you're not writing all the time, but you're reading more than you're writing, I think you could. And config files is obviously a good use of that.
Yeah, and I'm curious. So how do you authenticate when you're across all these different machines to get to your Azure Files?
When it uses your standard storage ID, right, the storage name and the storage key, the shared key, so it uses that and it stores it securely in Linux on the Linux side, in the Linux equivalent of a secret store or secret vault. So it stores the credentials over there, and then the driver just reads it from there and mounts it.
Nice.
Yeah. So using keys is not ideal. Ideally, I'd like to use something like Azure AD or something like that to mount it, but I think that's coming. That's not there yet.
Yeah, that's actually one of the updates that we talked about last week, that the AD authentication support on Azure Files came out as preview.
Yep. So once that is kind of generally available, we'll be able to. It's not available in the Linux mounting.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I don't think I saw anything Linux. It was just all Windows at the moment.
Yep. So that'll be the perfect solution. Then, as I said, you won't have to use those keys. You know, you can just use your AAD account.
Yeah, and rotating those keys and making sure that when you change one, you change all of them.
Mm-hmm. if people change it at all, that's the problem. No one changes the keys once you lock into it.
Yeah. Which, like, both are equally scary because changing it is scary because you need to make sure you change it everywhere you need to.
Well,
and then if you don't change it, then...
Well, that's why they have two keys, right? Your code should read one key. And then, or it should have two keys configured, right? And one doesn't work, it should use the other. That's how it should work. And this way you could use a primary key and
you can rotate one at a time.
Exactly. So you just do the rotation and your app will just pick the secondary key for now, or and then later on it'll pick the primary key. So that's how you do it.
And then do you essentially use Key Vault to save the key in and then access your Key Vault instead of the key itself?
Are you talking about in which scenario now? Not in the one that I just described, right? Not in the file share. Is that what you're asking?
Oh, yeah, I guess. If you were to access a file share from your code, you would still be able to access the Key Vault and then get the key.
Yeah, so in code, if you want to access the file share is already set up as a mount, right? So it just appears as a normal file system. You don't have to do anything from a code perspective. But if you wanted to connect to that storage account, specific storage account, using the storage name and the storage key, then you could get that from Key Vault. Yes, that's the correct place to put it. If you're accessing it from code, is you would put it in Key Vault. As I said, when I set it up on Linux, it stored it in the local Linux Key Vault equivalent, and they have a secret store built into the operating system. So that's where we stored it. But if you're writing an application, you need to store that, retrieve those credentials. I would get it from Key Vault. Is that what you were asking?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Good questions. Thank you. And thanks for sharing all that information about the AZ-900 exam. So we'll put some links on that, and I'll put some links on what I spoke about as well in terms of mounting the Azure files into our show notes, and we can call it a show then.
Sounds good to me.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.